Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is September 25th, 2002. This session is Planning for Sessions and Festivals. Living Liturgy, presented by Susan Briel. You can find this in our library or order this tape through the heading LIVLIT 2002-11. Let's see what she has to say.
Each of those worship services was in a different room and had a different musician and had a different everything. And so you could make some big plans together that made the worship of the congregation feel as if it were one worship. And yet there were particularities to the time of day and to the place that we gathered, how we would arrange the chairs and how we would bring the season into these rooms that the minute we left became something else, multi-purpose rooms, conference rooms, organ practice rooms. And then at Holden, what a joy to plan worship here, especially the year that Tom was the chief musician. We worship every single night here. So literally, one would plan 365 liturgies in the course of the year. That forms people. And I've never been on a more spirited committee than at Holden. Issues of language became hot. And there have been times where people would not even say the prayer if it addressed God in a way that wasn't authentic to them. The rumor is from Marty Haugen, the winter he lived here, that one Vespers was, everyone was given the book to sing evening prayer, LBW Vespers. And as they came in, they received the book and a paper bag, a brown paper bag. And they were told that as the liturgy began, the first time that something in that liturgy offended you, you were to put the bag on over your head. I don't know if anyone was bagless at the end, but the danger there is that the heart of the gospel kind of gets lost somewhere when we basically are issue-oriented rather than asking how this word calls us to be in worship, what forms us and propels us to do these things. So our job this morning is to encourage those of you who have worship committees that are active and to maybe give you some fresh ideas, and to encourage those who have inactive committees to either start a new one or light a fire, rekindle the faith that is in you. And for those of you who are burdened by the solitary planning of liturgy, to invite others in. And I would say if you were starting, don't open it up, who wants to be on? Really, look for the gifts that are in your parish and a variety of gifts. And if you have multiple services, people who normally come to each one of them should be on this committee. Tom, did you want to say something about... You can jump in anytime you want. Okay. The other rubric that we work with Living Liturgy is to plan seasonally. First, to plan for the whole year, to look at the biggest picture of the year coming up. The year we're entering this Advent is sometimes called the year of Mark, because we will be reading many, many of our gospel readings from Mark. Though one could argue that the liturgical year, every year, is really a Johannine year, that John actually, and his theology, shapes the liturgical year. Think about what we read on our great feast days, Christmas morning, Easter morning. Think of the great Lenten texts of the of the text in John of Nick at night, the woman at the well, the man born blind, the raising of Lazarus, all of these baptismal texts that lead us to the great dying and rising of Easter. So the year belongs to John. He is the central... he is the central jewel in the crown, and the synoptics gather around. You laugh. The problem is it just happens to be true. So, all right. So, as we would encourage you that sometime in late August or early September. Or early October now, it's never too late, to gather the whole committee to look at the year, to look at the way the seasons lead into one another, and to remind yourselves, your musicians, your leaders, to remind everybody who is present of the gift of these seasons, the deep longing and waiting and hoping of Advent, where the heart yearns for the one to come at the end of time into human history in the infant and every week in the breaking of bread and the sharing of the cup. And that longing and waiting and hoping finds its great fulfillment in the season of the incarnation, the season of love in the flesh, where in this one, in human time and history and place, God breaks in such a way that our hearts are drawn to receive God unafraid in this baby. And yet, who is this one? As we move into the season of lights, the season of Epiphany, the days when this Word made flesh and His gospel goes out to all of the nations, we start turning the question of who Jesus is. Is he prophet? Yes. Messiah? Yes. Healer? Yes. Proclaimer? Yes. All of this is the one we adored in the manger and now whom we are called to follow to the ends of the earth. And then the great turning toward the season of Lent, the season of emptying, the season of springtime and renewal, the season where the earliest church prepared those who were preparing to enter into the waters of baptism, prepared them in the most intense and deep way to see themselves as Nicodemus seeking at night for the truth, to see themselves as the woman at the well, thirsty for a word, thirsty for a water she cannot name that will heal her exile and her broken life, to see themselves and the whole assembly once again as the one born blind who is washed in the waters of Siloam, washed in the waters of the Sent One, and raised to new life, given new eyes and insight with which to see the world and to know Christ Jesus, and to see themselves and the whole assembly again as Lazarus, dead and buried in our tombs, cut off from relationship and human life, and then hearing our names called by the one who knows us by name, by the one whose voice we know, out from death and into life. That great season of renewal that we call Lent. Many, many Lutherans grew up with a Lent that was really walking once again the dusty road to Calvary, as if we didn't know that road, its end. And I am of a mind that we should return, that we might benefit our communities to return to the more ancient practice of baptism and baptismal renewal. For here too is the cross of Christ. Here too is our dying with him and our being raised. So it is true that any time you have baptisms at the Easter Vigil, those great Johannine texts can be your Lenten texts, regardless of the season that you're in. And then all of this springtime waiting comes to full flower as we enter the great holy 3 days and taste the sweet manna and the milk of the resurrection on Easter. For 50 days we glory in the resurrection, surrounded by golden sunlight and bright, wonderful news that death has been conquered. That it isn't just the Easter feast, that you don't simply let the lilies wilt one at a time, deadheading the ones that droop until by the third Sunday of Easter, the whole church looks as if it's drooping. How do you sustain for the length of a season the joy of the resurrection and anticipation of our third great festival? The festival in the Christian church that the culture has not yet found a way to package, market, and sell. I love the work of the Holy Spirit that resists. Oh, she blows where she will, you know, and you know not from where or when. But that fiery red giving of the Spirit that quickens our faith again and sends us out like those first disciples running from Emmaus, like Mary Magdalene, the first preacher of the gospel, the apostle to the apostles. I have in fact seen the Lord and now have received the gift of the Holy Spirit to share that good news with you. And then into the what we sometimes call the great green days, that long season, what the Roman Catholics call ordinary time. We sometimes call it the seasons after the Sundays after the Pentecost. But I'm quite taken by the image of ordinary time. Here we are in our lives day by day. No great festival of Christ to celebrate, but that very true word we hear in the gospel, that Christ comes to us at the times, in the places, and through the people we least expect. That God comes to us in the ordinary work of our hands, into our homes, into the places that we live out our baptismal vocation of tending to the needs of our neighbor and the needs of a broken world. To just take them once again on that journey through the year and to give them images, to give, remind yourself of the way color and movement might enhance the meaning of each of these seasons and help the people into them. One of the great gifts that Dorothy Ramsland gave me, gave the parish, was that during Epiphany, she commissioned these gorgeous clear glass candle holders of all different shapes and sizes, and the light just kept growing through the season of Epiphany till there was a flooding of this light. And how dramatic then on Ash Wednesday that light was gone and a darkness fell. And we turned again to remember we're made of dust, not just starlight, but dust, frail and fragile and mortal. When each season is planned visually, textually, up out of the word we're called to read and proclaim during that season, when the whole assembly sees that the turning of the seasons are more than head knowledge, you experience them. As a young pastor, I was so taken by this notion that on Easter morning, I wanted my people to enter into the sanctuary at Our Savior's Bellingham and to enter it because we didn't yet have a vigil. I had no flowers, no light, no music, no trumpet, no hymn. They came into that sanctuary and sat in silence and in darkness at 11 o'clock on Easter morning in Bellingham, Washington. And then with the opening hymn, in came the flowers, the lights, the banners, the vestments. Well, that did not go over well. I was in liturgy heaven, and we instituted the Eucharist on the feast of the resurrection. We thought it might be good to have a little feast there. The argument against it, of course, was too many visitors. It's your one chance to do what you do, you know. But Frances Ford, bless her heart, which is what you say before you say something unkind, and then you're automatically... Frances Ford, at some deep level, got exactly what that was. She came up to me with fire in her eyes and anger on her lips. I brought a friend for the first time to this church on Easter morning. I brought her to my church, and we walked in and sat down as if we were in a tomb. A good worship committee will save you from such ritual glitches as being, as I was, so enamored with something that could happen that I had in no way prepared the assembly for, had done none of the forum or teaching that would allow them. What I should have done is instituted a vigil where that is a most appropriate movement from darkness into light, and worship gladly with my husband and the two other people who would have come and started it that way. So you have one great retreat. Maybe go away to a retreat center. Maybe ask them to spend a night, to cook together, to eat together, to pray together, and to look at this whole great year, to read Mark together, aloud to one another, to pray with this gospel that will be the opening of the word for us for the rest of the year. And you ministers who lead, to read a commentary on Mark. My recent favorite is Binding the Strong Man by Ched Myers. And its accompanying book, Say to This Mountain, that is set more like a Bible study. But there are other really fine commentaries on Mark. And then you could break into smaller subgroups, taking seasons and meeting then with the Christmas cycle people, the Advent, Christmas, Epiphany people who could see the movement of that trinity of seasons as one whole, and imagine how in proclamation, imagine how in setting the table, imagine how in gathering the people, we might be led from waiting and hoping to love in the flesh, to light to the nations. And another group who would take on Lent and Easter to the Feast of Pentecost, and then maybe a couple of groups who could divide up the weeks of ordinary time, so that when you get to those long dog days of the Sundays after Pentecost, you know, where I'm the only pastor I know who welcomes the five consecutive weeks on John 6, the bread of life. But I've written a hymn for it, so it's one for each week. And with those seasonal planning people, to move more deeply into the meaning of the season and to read and pray these texts together, and with an artist and musicians and proclaimers and readers and worshipers, prepare for the people, set the table for the people, for the Feast of the Word and the Feast of the Table. Then there is some just nitty-gritty stuff. And that might just come down to the pastor and the musician working together. What setting of this? I wouldn't give the worship committee the setting of the psalm choice necessarily. You know, some of those decisions just need to be made by the people for whom this is the gift, unless you've got an exceptional committee. But think how that would form the committee. You might find, as I did at PLU, that people come up to you. Do I have to actually be a member of this church to be on the worship planning committee? We say, nobody's a member of this church. Come to the worship planning committee. Baptists and Presbyterians and Episcopalians and Methodists and lifelong Lutherans saying for the first time, that's what it was. Or that's what you do. And hearing, even in the flow of the season, the Paschal mystery proclaimed with a different accent. So, we encourage you to, huh? Now, Tom.
Would you have the worship committee, though, involved in the choosing of the setting?
Yes.
And I just have some questions again. I mean, I'm wondering how many of you use pretty much the same setting of the Eucharist all year long. Is there anyone that just uses one setting all year? Okay. What about, are there congregations here that change the setting according to Sunday? For instance, the first and third might be something, the second and fourth another, or they're all different each Sunday of the month? Okay. What about changing your settings every couple of months, 2, 3, 4 months? Yeah, well, that would be the... how many of you change them according to season? Okay.
Oh, we're preaching to what? The choir.
And then one more. How many have multiple services so that your early service would have one setting and your second service would have another setting? Or, okay. You don't have a setting, meaning... With the, I think that's a setting with one voice, setting six, you know, kind of doesn't use it. Yeah. You know, I guess it's pretty obvious what Susan's saying is that to think about having your worship committee think about the settings changing with the seasons rather than just saying, okay, every 3 months we're going to change what we do.
Yeah. So you ask yourself what kind of music would undergird the meaning and message of this season? How would the proclamation be made? So the setting during Lent would have a different, and by setting we mean the way that the ordinary, that the way that the, what's the other language for that? I mean, the framework of the liturgy is sung or proclaimed, that the feeling of Lent is different than the brightness of Epiphany. In my parish, they do a jazz setting during Epiphany, and people just love it. But when you come to that first Sunday of Lent, you know you've turned.
Yeah.
You know you're in the season of moving in a new direction. And for many of us, frankly, it's welcomed. I'm ready. I love the jazz setting, but I'm ready by Lent 1 to turn. Then when Easter comes, kaboombo.
Here at Holden in 99, we did a paperless global service during Epiphany that was very celebrative. And then first Sunday of Lent, we did Gregorian chant unaccompanied for the entire season of Lent and had some real complainers about it. But by the fifth or sixth week, some people really fell in love with it and moved into Lent, and they weren't ready to go to Easter when we again changed and
That's
had
right.
a lot more going on instrumentally.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Somebody had questions.
Yes. Yeah. That makes sense to me. Yeah. Yes.
I think the word setting is a mystery for a lot of people.
Okay.
Okay. It occurs to me you talked a lot about food and feeding, and it's like the same food with a different table setting, different dishes.
Oh, what a gorgeous image. What she's saying is this word setting, which is kind of an in-house word, I guess. When you're using a composed through liturgy, the setting would be, you know, what the Kyrie, the Gloria, the Offertory, the Sanctus, you know, that, how that set, the musical style or key. But she's saying the mystery of that might be solved if you think of a meal, that the way you set your table for Easter dinner is different than the way you set your table on a Wednesday in July. And it's different than when you're picnicking and birthday parties. Just think of how you would set your table. How would you adorn this space for this event? And you might think in your own home, at your own table, if you gather around one, which might be a discipline to encourage your parish in once a week at least to share a meal. What small thing could you place at the center of your table once the Advent wreath is gone? What could you place there that bespeaks the proclamation of the word during that season?
And you know, that's such a beautiful image because it reminds me how in your home when you do change your setting for a feast and the family comes, more of your family comes, oftentimes there's a beloved icon or certain things that the children especially are always looking for. When we went to Grandma's house for Christmas dinner, she would always make chicken balls. That was my one side of my Norwegian grandma family. The most delicious, light, and flavorful that she had ground 6 times through the meat grinder, chicken balls with this beautiful gravy. But I always looked for her gravy bowl. And I think this is true, too, when we're planning liturgy and we talk about tradition and contemporary and remembering that both in our space, we have to find those beloved icons that need to be with us when we come back around to that season, mm-hmm. as well as maybe the beloved song or the beloved setting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. John, and then Marty.
When you're changing your setting, it's a fairly regular uh-huh. instead of like a year, 2 years, how do you introduce that?
But what I would do then, if this is a new setting to the people, I would do it during Lent and teach it during Lent in its most simple form with simple instrumentation, and then I'd keep it for Easter so that that setting holds that whole cycle together, but add now to the setting trumpets or timpani so that even the music can bespeak one emotion or one mode, but then change at the season. So I think for smaller parishes, they couldn't do what we do. We're so lucky in our parish. We're probably literate in 6 or 8 different liturgies and flexible and easy to learn. In lots of parishes, you can't do that. But then I would think of how would you want to present the Christ cycle and the Christmas cycle, and then the Lent-Easter cycle. Marty, do you want to respond more to that about teaching settings?
One of my goals is, if a setting doesn't sit... one of the stories I heard is about an architect who wouldn't put sidewalks down on a college campus until 3 years after the campus had been laid out, and then he put the sidewalks where the grass was dead. And I think when you sing through a setting... if it's not going to be easily learned within a week or two each part, it's not going to be learned well over 10 or 12 weeks. The choir will learn it, the musicians will learn it. A song like Lalo Lalo, I mean, you heard that, you sang it. There are some excellent traditional and contemporary settings that can be learned well and easily, and I think Susan's right. I actually tried, if a setting can't work a cappella, instruments won't save it. What I wanted to refer to, though, more was the reason, and I think, like Susan said, you're preaching to the choir, but one of the reasons to really have a setting used substantially is that it allows the hymn of the day and the psalm to really stand out. If you're changing the music all around, this becomes one more thing that gets lost in the shuffle. But that it's that grand, I almost think it like a frame mm-hmm. where the picture mm-hmm. can change, and then
that
stands out in contrast to it. And the other thing was, when Susan talks about this wonderful evocative nature, I want musicians from every one of my groups at the meetings, if they have different leaders, one for consistency across the liturgies, so that if someone goes to a different service on Sunday, they don't feel they wandered into the wrong church. That's what I said yesterday about all the music for all the people. But secondly, not just the committee picking the setting, but the musicians pick up all this evocativeness about light, the way you use space. And then when I look at psalm settings, I'm not only thinking about the setting of the text and the music, but I'm also thinking, how is this going to fit with all the rest of the stuff we're talking about for the season?
Mm-hmm. That's so helpful to think of what sometimes are divided into the what's ordinary, what stays the same in the liturgy week by week, and the propers, the things that change seasonally or change weekly. That framework, you do want to have that like a skeleton in your bones, so that what changes is what we see and hear, and that framework, in a sense, carries us through prayer. My own daughter, who's 16, is such a defender of the liturgy, and a liturgy that is deep in her bones, because she said recently, I am in a time of unbelief. And it's the liturgy that holds me to the community. And I, because it's, this is the community I want to be in, this is where I think my faith might return. And if it were different every week, how could she be held in that? I mean, she leans back on that framework, like she leans on her community during a season of unbelief. And each of us has those seasons. And at any given time, somebody in your parish is at a time of great doubt or struggle or unbelief or anger. And something touchstones that hold us together, not just this little congregation and the way it's decided to do it, but it's a framework that whose bones are, have been strong enough to sustain 2,000 years, whose skeleton is still firm, not bent by osteoporosis and not limbs cut off because of gangrene, but that steady, steady framework. And it holds us in the Church Catholic, too.
I want to say one more thing about settings and the mystery of that. In the parish that I'm in, I'm not a musician there because I'm traveling around, but in my home parish, we don't have a set setting that we use really ever anymore. We don't use Now the Feast, we don't use the LBW, we don't use any set setting. We almost always use what is called With One Voice Setting 6. But look in With One Voice on page 8. We really start there, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this because I think the session that's the day-to-day or the week-to-week planning might get into this. But this is the rite, and the capital, I think of the capital letter items as big T. I mean, that's what needs to stay, and the lowercase ones may or may not be there. It's a very helpful worship planning aid. And then if you turn to page 42 in the front, that's setting 6, and that's what our congregation uses. But we don't change it every Sunday. We change the places, the Kyrie, the hymn of praise, the gospel acclamation, the way we pray, the presentation of the gifts, the great thanksgiving, the canticle. We've changed those seasonally so that our setting 6 during Lent is very different from our setting 6 during Advent or Christmas. And we found this, you know, we use this a lot. And the options they give in there for music are just from With One Voice, but we draw from a much broader set of music. But we found this piece helpful in our planning of a setting. And so when you say you don't have a setting, I don't know if that's what you meant. We don't have one either. We make it up, but we make it up seasonally. Is that what you were talking about? Okay, yeah.
There's questions out
there. Yes.
I'm wondering about the logistics of a paperless service. Like, did you have to announce, you know, now we'll see the Kyrie on page, or the Holy Holy? I mean, how did you do that? No Holy.
By paperless, he means no book.
Well, no book except for maybe the hymn of the day.
Okay.
But, I think it would be much like when we just did listen, O people, there was no introduction to that, and you didn't need any paper. But that could be a gospel acclamation for the day. Or when we led a psalm, we didn't need you to know anything, you just sang back what was sung to you. So a lot of the paperless stuff was either call and response or short repetitive refrains for the Kyrie, for the hymn of praise. Sometimes it was African music that's repetitive, African-American tradition. Much of their services is without people looking at books. It's difficult to pull off. We may try that tomorrow night. We haven't really planned Eucharist tomorrow, so maybe you'll be confronted with a paperless liturgy tomorrow and can see what that's like.
It does require of the assembly some formation and basic responses so that when the presider says, "The Lord be with you," the assembly knows what to say. So the catch there is that welcoming to the newcomer, to the stranger, to the one who is unfamiliar. The good side of it is I think many people in our parishes have more of that response memorized than we give them credit for. It's just maddening, isn't it, when you're the presider and you say, "The Lord be with you," and people are going, "And also with you," as if they had to read that, most of them. So it does, even at the, you know, even the conversation or the dialogue at that beginning of the praise at the table, lift up your hearts, that people have to know what it is to respond. So there is formation that has to be done there.
And some of it is cultural. It depends who the new people are who are coming into your parish. If those new people can't read English, if their sight is bad, or if they're illiterate, sometimes a paperless service is more welcoming to them than a lot of pieces of paper or a lot of books. That becomes very confusing. So,
and I would include in that, we don't mean by paperless you don't have paper, but then you put everything printed on the screens, because that takes the eye a different direction. So we maybe, instead of saying paperless, we should say
oral.
Mm-hmm. It's challenging. Yes?
Would you comment, and perhaps other colleagues also, on the usefulness or the lack thereof of adopting a seasonal thematic thread that carries you like, through the season of Lent?
I know pastors who do that with some real grace if the theme comes up out of the Word. It has to, again, be servant to the Word. I also have been talking to pastors who say, well, during Lent we don't do the lectionary at all. I do a series on, and Luther did say, preaching on the Catechism, preaching on the Lord's Prayer, the Apostles' Creed, our people need that. I think I'd save that for ordinary time.
Or
midweek services. But I do know pastors who are really taken by this idea of themes. And one person here, whom I won't look at right now, said that the advantage of going with a set theme for Lent is that you can find the sermons written already for you. The person who told me this was not the one who was doing the preaching, but what did I think about the pastor who did this? And I'm not going to answer that question, but I think that's a tricky thing, isn't it? If we're getting a theme so that we can really borrow something that was written out of the context of this people. So I don't know if themes work. My friend Carrie Reichwam in Dillon, Colorado, is great with this. I mean, one time she had an aspen tree beside her font through this whole season, and this image of gathering around the tree just. And she said, you look at these lessons, and it just keeps coming up and coming up. And they brought a tree right into the sanctuary. It was great.
I thought I just mentioned when you talked about setting and space in the reading hall, you know, and so forth. So I think usually we think of something coming in, like the candles and the Epiphany, the Advent wreath, and so forth. But sometimes there's also things that can leave.
Yes.
In Parashester in Lent, they pick off the Verbenas behind the kind of the old high altar.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. I think many of us could scale down in order that the focus be on what is central, what is strong at the heart of our worship. So you might even take a newcomer through your sanctuary and say, you know, where is it too much? Where is it too busy? A bare branch during Lent. I worshiped at St. Leo's Catholic Church in Tacoma, and during Advent they had a big tree stump, just this huge stump that sat there week after week after week and was almost never, that I know of, referred to until Christmas. Somehow it was growing, a tree of life was coming up out of it, and then people were going, "Ooh, from the stump of Jesse." Any other my teammate, yes, and then.
Well, we have an interesting small congregation, and when I was called, the organist left, which was a hardship and a blessing at the same time. So now we have a piano player who's not, and we have a guitarist. And so they switch back and forth. And so what we've been doing is there's one setting for the piano and one setting for the guitar, depending on who's doing what on what Sunday. But I connect it then with they have the same readings, the same prayers. The music is different, but it's still connected throughout the season. So it's just kind of a different spin.
And you do need to make those pastoral decisions depending on where you are and who is in your parish. I mean, we can stand up here and talk about a way to do it, but then you take that home and you filter it through the parish you serve, where you are serving as ministers. Yes.
What about the little tea that has become the big tea of Christmas?
Thank you. Her question is about Advent and the small t that really, where the cultural winter festival has leaked out. We celebrate Christmas all the way to Christmas and then stop celebrating it. The next worship planning session that we have together will start us with Advent, and we'll talk specifically about that. So thank you. I mean, that is, we know pastors who've written, even I think in magazines, say, well, just get rid of Advent. It's not working. Let it go. And quit being such a grump about it. But then the question, then you have to have a big discussion with the ancestors. What do we lose if we let go of that? So thanks for raising it. Any of my colleagues want to respond, or should we keep doing this?
Tom, I wanted to ask you to respond to a question. Let's say you find yourself in a parish that has multiple services and perhaps different liturgies, a different liturgy at a 9 o'clock service and another one at 11. Make the case then still for one unified worship committee, even though you have two different services.
And maybe those two services out of necessity accompanied by different instrumentation, because that's what you've had. I still think, let's look at what we have in common, these things we hold in common. The skeleton of the liturgy is the same. It's still word and sacrament. The readings are still the same. We have the same lectionary. The season we are in is still the same. So many of the prayers will be the same. And in some ways, if you do that basic common planning together, I think people will begin to see that the style of music that enfleshes and enhances and illumines the skeleton can change according to the gifts and talents of the people who gather. So if you worship on a Saturday evening, that's going to have a different feel than the bright light of Sunday morning, but not different readings. And you might also, because we feel strongly about all the people of God should be able to enjoy the gifts of all the music of God's people. So I would even urge you to find common ways. Let's say you're doing a chanted psalm at your organ liturgy at 11 in the morning on Sunday. Then chant that psalm with other instrumentation. If you're doing a different kind of setting of the psalm, maybe choose the psalm to be the same so people learn each other's music. I'd urge you to keep the hymn of the day the same at those liturgies. If you sing ostinato refrains going to communion at one liturgy and just have organ playing at the other, let the organ playing people learn and sing those songs. Then you are less likely to be creating two different communities and two different congregations in your midst who don't share a common language and who can't come together to worship. In too many churches, I mean, it's summer in my home church where I grew up, one Sunday is contemporary, one Sunday is traditional, one Sunday is contemporary. And then you have communion based on whatever that service would have been doing that week. Because they say they have weekly communion, but it's first and third at one service and second and fourth at the other. And you just have no idea. You just feel jerked around. And I feel jerked around. I think that's a perfect time to say, how can these styles come together? How can we appreciate the gifts and loves of one another? So, this is your stuff.
No, yeah, well, yeah. There's one big T that we haven't mentioned yet, and completely outside of everything. For most of Christian history, it was normative to have one gathering on Sunday. That was big T. The whole community gathered together once. And now, obviously for pastoral and sociological reasons, that's no longer happening. But we still have to keep that big T in mind when we start planning. We can't suddenly say, now we can have two services, because that's...
If I understand, Orthodox still only have one liturgy on Sunday. But I had two things. One is what we already referred to, but would be suggestions on how to move a congregation from Holy Communion twice a month to every Sunday. I'd be curious how many twice a month congregations are here, because it's including mine.
Twice a month? Once a month.
Mm-hmm.
A few still?
Yeah.
Every single week?
But different service.
No, okay, different. How many of you do that flip-flop like Spanaway Lutheran? Different services. So you say we have the Eucharist, but no community is actually formed by that weekly. Yeah. Huh?
Only the Baptists.
Yeah. We need all the grace we can get.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then the second one is just a comment. When we were at PLU, there was a praise service on Wednesday nights that we went to.
You went to.
Well,
I had to be home with my babies.
Yeah, right. But what I remember about that, there was no sense of the church here, because the music is the same all year. And I would wonder, are there praise songs being written for the seasons, or is this just a given? And I think it's a real question about using this music.
Mm-hmm. One of the gifts of the seasons is that we get to sing the whole song of the life of faith. There are times to lament. There are times to long. There are times to rejoice, times to wait, and times to receive. And without that, I mean, I think each season we are taught the prayers and the songs and the psalms and the hymns of that season of the church year for the time when we ourselves, as individuals, communities, families, or nations, are entering a Lent of our own. September 12th did not come during, or September 11th did not come during Lent. But we now had a people who need to know songs of "Where Were You, God?" "I Cry for You." And even those psalms that cry out for vengeance and then back away and say, "But this is yours, O God, to do." To train the heart of a community only in praise is not to help, it's to help fail to help the community to live their lives through all of these seasons. I mean, some of you have probably had long, long Advents. And you get to Christmas and there isn't any love in the flesh for you. But your community stands around you and sings the songs of the church, so that when the incarnation breaks in, you say, "I know that song." They sing the songs of Easter when you are yet mourning, so that when the weeping that has lasted so many long nights gives way to the joy of the dawn, you have a hymn to sing. You know a song in your heart. You know a psalm. That's part of what the church year gives to us too, is a rich palette of lament and praise and longing and hope and confession, so that we can speak with God. We can know that God is present with us in all of those seasons. Yes. Right.
In our libraries, have those four hymns, and have the text, and have the music, and perhaps have a musician or a lay person go and sing hymns with them. I think they can do liturgy throughout the whole week. Number two, it's an opportunity for parents to teach their children that whole the liturgy, because they've got, not everybody has a piano, not everybody can do music, but at least memorize the words so that they grow into.
They, yes. And that was one of the questions raised that we wrote down, is how do you extend the hospitality and the work of the people to those who are homebound? There's a wonderful ancient tradition, and it is ours too, but rarely practiced, which is called the extension of the table, where at the close of the meal, not only are gifts taken out to the poor and hungry and the orphaned and the stranger, but bread and wine is taken by Eucharistic ministers to the homebound, not kept in the backseat of your car for 2 days until you can make the trip, but taken then as an extension of this table. And as John is saying, if you can also then take with you the scripture readings, the hymn, the prayers, and really extend that liturgy to the hospital room, to the hospice, to the shut-in, to the nursing home. That's very helpful for formation. And it's a wonderful ministry to institute in your congregation, just to have the Eucharistic ministers who are going to do this work, and it takes training, but to come forward at the close of the meal, to hand them bread and wine, and to pray as our gifts go out into the world, including this gift of the very presence of Christ among us. So there is a good word for a liturgy. Also a good word for congregation, for families to have the worship book of your denomination at home. In my church, at some point in the confirmation process, the students receive a Lutheran book of worship, which is still the book of our denomination, and there they can also learn and see. Yes, Peter.
Can you comment on the way that we eat the meal? For instance, wafers versus bread, intinction versus the common cup. It seems like we're in a hurry. We've got to go to intinction because we have a baptism.
Right. Yes, I will answer that, and then we'll sing a hymn. Because our time is up, not because of any other reason. Okay. Yeah, these are small T things in some ways. But let me, I have not talked to my teammates about this, so I'll just tell you where I am, and I'll say to people who are members of my synod, I don't know your bishop's answer to these questions, and I'm not speaking for him. So no nasty letters to him about what his uncontrollable wife said. First, I would commend to the Lutherans among you, among us, if you don't have it or don't have several copies, to go to the bookstore here and buy the little red booklet called The Use of the Means of Grace. This comes as close to anything we have had in North America as a common, to a common agreement about how word and sacrament worship is in our church. And there it's confessional. It's deeply scriptural. It's true to our heritage, and it's open to the future. And I think if you have a worship planning committee, this is not the information saved by the pastor. This could be even a great book for teaching about what it is we do when we gather around word and sacrament. How do we receive the bread and the wine? This, in some ways, is culturally and in some way cultural bound, and in some ways shaped by the traditions in your home parish, and in some places shaped by architecture. When we were at PLU, we had wonderful Namibian students there, and I remember Kuva coming up to me after Eucharist, where we had intinction, and the people came forward and received the bread from the presider, and then either went this way or that way with the cup of wine to dip in. And he was deeply, deeply offended by that, because what he had to do in that instance was so against his culture's practice of eating and drinking anywhere, at home, at a party, or at church, that you never put food in your mouth and walk while you chew. That was offensive to him. And of all places that he was unable to take the bread and to take it into himself and then to receive the wine, but this sort of walking. And he said, and people do it on campus all the time. They're just walking around eating. But at least here. So that was an eye-opener to me. You know that at the Reformation, the cup was restored to the people. That's part of the Reformation, that the people receive the sacrament, as we say, in both kinds, both the bread and the cup. We need to remember also that our tradition teaches that Christ is fully present for us to forgive our sins and bring us newness of life under one kind, under the bread alone. In, with, and under the bread, Christ is present. The cup and bread are offered to all of the people. But if for some deep reason a communicant would see this cup as dangerous to them or unhealthy for them, then I would ask that person to take the bread, knowing, because you've catechized the congregation, this is the full sacrament, to stop at the cup and reverence it. Some people kiss the cup. I had one alcoholic in Bellingham who said to me, and I'm not saying this is true for all alcoholics, but he said, I haven't touched alcohol in 20-some years. I don't remember what it was. But I always receive the wine at Holy Communion because I believe the words that this is for my health and my salvation. Well, he didn't drink much, but he clung to that promise. And somehow, in the economy of his addiction, this worked. So, and about children taking the wine, again, they can commune under one kind, or as my children, whose synapses are still working beautifully, who have received from the cup every Sunday of their lives since the day they were weaned, and they were nursed way too long. But by the time... and there is no evidence that children who receive the wine at Eucharist have a higher risk of becoming alcoholics, becoming binge drinkers in college, becoming any of that. In fact, there is evidence that where alcohol is used with respect and honor among families, there's less inclination to go off to college and drink till you're blind. So, do we eat wafers versus bread? My preference is that the elements of Holy Communion really bespeak the meal. As Lutherans, we say that finiti capax infinitum, that wonderful thing, that this finite bread does, in fact, in with and under it, bear to us the infinite presence of Christ, his mercy and his love for us. And so the idea of actually breaking bread, which is the earliest church's word for this meal that we share, the breaking of the bread, to actually break bread and to eat from a common loaf, carries with it this image that we too are one body, and that the many, as the Didache speaks, you know, all the grains of wheat have been gathered now into one in this bread. So that symbol of the bread is powerful to me. It doesn't mean that those of you who use wafers are not, it's not the sacrament, but the question is, what does it speak? John Schramm, you can tell John Schramm's story? John Schramm tells this, or do you want to tell it? John Schramm tells the story that he was visiting a woman in a nursing home, and in this nursing home they practiced reality therapy. Every day they would say, today is Tuesday, your name is Margaret, and this is what's going to happen. And he came with word and sacrament to her nursing home room and read scriptures and all of this, prepared her for the meal, and then lifted up the wafer, and she said, it's Tuesday, I'm Margaret, and I do not eat paper. Again, the symbolism of one cup. It's very interesting. I think the small T tradition, if you guys want to read a great book about the way grape juice entered the Christian meal, read White Bread Protestants. It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and you learn about Welch and his Methodist inventions and how it was to his advantage that Methodists begin using grape juice. But again, I would say, again, the common cup says something, doesn't it? It not only says we are one, but it's the risk of drinking out of the same cup, that you would drink from the cup I drink from, and I from yours. It says something about the amount of risk I'm willing to take in your life. Now, people said, well, can't you catch AIDS or something? There's no evidence that you can. The person at risk is the person with a weakened immune system, because they can just be vulnerable to every little germ that's there. So again, these are pastoral decisions, but when you make them not just because someone has come to you and said, do this, but make them, ask the big questions about what we're saying and what we're doing and how the people are being fed at this table, whether they kneel during Lent and then during Easter stand as a sign of the resurrection, whether they come forward and intinct or drink. I would say pastorally make the decision, but ask the big questions about this meal when you're making them. Yeah. We're going to sing a hymn, and after Dan speaks, you can open your books too.
This is a scientific report.
Okay. Yes. Do you have it written on the palm of your hand?
Yeah, but read recently that intinction is the most germ-passing form of sharing.
Thank you, Dan, for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
That's because people's fingers get into the wine, and people do not wash their hands well. And John, I mean, I think it's an argument for abundant toilet paper, but now we're going to... We'll rise and sing hymn 802.